Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, movements in the economies, national and international, that shape our jobs, our incomes, our debts, everything about economic affairs. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. I currently teach at the New School University in New York City, and I also write columns for the website truthout.org. This is an independent and courageous source of economic analysis, as well as other kinds of analysis, that is available to you free of charge on a daily basis. I'm proud to work with them, and I urge you to take a look at truthout.org. For those of you interested in the kinds of analysis that you hear on this program, that you hopefully come back to this program to get more of, should know that we maintain two websites where you can go at any time that's convenient to you and see much more of this material written down in audio forms, in video forms, in whole classes, in lectures, an immense cornucopia of materials assembled by us for you. The first website is rdwolf.com, and the second one, democracyatwork.info. The first one has all of my work on it, and the second one is more devoted to this notion that reorganizing enterprises, making workers their own bosses in worker self-directed enterprises, sometimes called worker co-ops, is a way to solve many of the problems that we discuss and analyze on this program. So again, if you want to see this kind of work, also if you want to communicate with us, to suggest topics for us to cover, to raise questions, to offer criticisms, we welcome and read it all. You can go to either of these two websites to communicate directly with us, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. And please remember to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest in order to show and to engage us through social media. Okay, let me turn then to the updates for this week's program, the short analytics with which we begin each program before getting into more substantial analyses or interviewing my guests. The first piece of information I want to bring to your attention is the decision of the political authorities in France to move against the Amazon Corporation, this now enormous giant that distributes goods and services around the world. And they're also, by the way, targeting the Google Corporation, Facebook, and Apple. And it's usually for the same sort of thing, but I'm going to focus on the struggle between France as a society and a government and the Amazon Corporation. The French are asserting that Amazon is trying to become what they call a quasi-monopolist. And what they're doing, according to the French, is cornering cheap distribution systems, highly automated, and also offering books particular at a discount. In France, the amount that you can discount a book is limited by the government. So you can't have some people offering much larger discounts as a mode of competition. The French government therefore limits Amazon in how much discount it can offer, which limits how much it can compete in that way. And it gives an argument for this. It says that what Amazon has done and what they will not permit it to do again is to outcompete others, drive them out of business because they are big enough and can afford to do it. And as soon as they've driven out smaller rivals and they're all alone, a quasi-monopoly, they jack back up the price, recover what they lost before, and present the buying community with worse conditions than were there before Amazon ever arrived. The second thing that the French government accuses Amazon of is evading and avoiding taxes by creating shell corporations, particularly in neighboring Luxembourg, having the profits of Amazon really derived from their business in France show up instead as the profits in Luxembourg, because the taxes in Luxembourg are much lower than they are in France, and that they don't want to permit a corporation to behave this way, to evade the taxes it ought to be paying on the business it does in France, and to destroy lots of French smaller companies to establish the kind of monopoly that will in the end be a burden on the French economy. And of course, Amazon is saying, oh, we're not doing that, or we won't do it, or you have no right to do it, or nobody else in the world does it, and we won't do business in France if you insist on this. The usual fight back and forth. I want to shed some light on this fight, because the outcome is not 100% clear yet, although most folks are betting on the French government winning this and that Amazon will accept it and simply hope that it doesn't happen elsewhere. But whatever the outcome finally is, let's remember something. For much of the early history of the United States, we as a nation blocked the corporations from England and other European countries on exactly the same grounds. Then it was known as the infant industry argument. It went like this. We have to nurture and give special protections and even subsidies to our little businesses here in the United States so they can become big enough to have the strength to really fairly compete with the much larger, older companies that have been established in Europe. You might call this saying, we're not going to have real competition until we have a level playing field on which to compete. In that way, the French government is saying, look, Amazon has been helped by the large, rich American economy. We in France are much smaller. We can't get the economies of scale that an American economy, you know, our population is a fraction of the American, and plus Amazon has been helped by decisions to hobble the post office so that people needed Amazon rather than using the post office. All kinds of arguments the French are making, saying we have to help our industry by blocking Amazon until we're big enough to compete on a level playing ground with Amazon. So when Amazon expresses outrage, I want everyone to understand they're outraged because they're on the wrong side of this struggle compared with their predecessors here in the United States who used exactly the same argument to persuade government officials in America to do to European companies then what the European countries are trying to do to American companies now, and we shouldn't act all shocked and outraged given what that history actually is. Second, there are offsetting consequences. You know, it isn't only the lower price. Let's give Amazon the benefit of the doubt. Let's imagine that they actually can and will continue to deliver books and various other articles at a price somewhat lower than what people were paying for them before. Let's assume that. Give Amazon the benefit of the doubt on that subject. Is that enough of an argument to let Amazon do its thing? And the answer is crystal clear. No, it isn't. Should never have been. Why? Well, how do you count that when Amazon delivers cheaper goods, it throws out of business hundreds, maybe thousands of companies that were delivering goods and services very nicely, thank you, ma'am, all around France? Well, you'd have to somehow weigh the benefit to the buyer of a lower price against the costs to all the employees, all the shareholders of the companies that are driven out of business, all the taxes not paid by bankrupt businesses, bankrupt by competition from Amazon. You'd have to see what happened to the communities that don't get taxes from those bankrupt companies, what cutbacks in services those communities have to now impose on their people, reduce school fees, reduce school teacher. Before you look at all the consequences, you don't know whether the gains to whoever gets them from lower prices is greater or lesser than the cost to society of the wiping out of the others who had been doing it. The blithe assurance that the gains of lower price far outweigh, That's something the people who want to support Amazon, that's what they say. That's what Amazon says. We're not surprised when Amazon says it. That's what they want. They get the profits. They don't pay the costs. If you really wanted to allow the society to make the decision, you'd have to give the citizens a real taste of what they gain with Amazon coming and what they lose from Amazon coming, and then let the society debate the subject and have a vote, make a decision. Amazon doesn't support that. Amazon thinks its chances are better going the route it has gone, getting permission from governments, telling them they'll give them a break here, there, the other place, in all the ways I assume are legal. But the truth of the matter is, we don't know what people want in this regard, because there's really no way to assess that. And we don't really know what the costs are. We know that Amazon wants it because Amazon gets the profits and doesn't pay the costs. What we don't know is what exactly the costs are, who will pay them, and how much we should weigh that loss against whatever gain Amazon gives us. An honest discussion of this topic would deal with all of that. A dishonest one simply says, gee, Amazon can do it less than somebody else. That's only the tip of the iceberg here. To make the decision on that basis is to not make it in a reasonable way or a rational way at all. I turn next, even though this is not normally my topic, to the economics of chicken nuggets. And here I want to bring to your attention a remarkable story. It comes from the state of Mississippi. And in fact, it has to do with a study done by the Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson, Mississippi, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And the lead author there, Dr. Richard D. DeShazzo. Reuters reported on this on the 4th of October. And here's what the medical center in Jackson, Mississippi did. It went to two major national chains, fast food chains. It has chosen not to release the names. I guess it's protecting them. And it got chicken nuggets at each of these two. And it then tested them in the laboratory for what they contained. So first, let me tell you what their results were, and then we'll analyze those results. The first nugget was made one half out of meat, that is, muscle tissue of a chicken. One half. What was the other half of the chicken nugget? I'm going to read it to you from the Reuters report. A mix of fat, blood vessels, and nerves, including cells that line the skin and the internal organs of the bird. This was all reported, by the way, in the online journal, the American Journal of Medicine, dated September 13th, 2013, and the Reuters report is based on that journal article. Wow. The second nugget was likewise tested. In it, only 40% of the nugget was meat, muscle tissue. And here was the remainder, and I'm going to read again from the Reuters report. Fat, cartilage, and bone. That's right. Ground up fat, cartilage, and bone. I'm now going to read from the conclusion of Dr. Richard DeShazzo of the University of Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson. We all know white chicken meat to be one of the best sources of lean protein available, and we encourage our patients to eat it. What has happened is that some companies have chosen to use an artificial mixture of chicken parts rather than low-fat chicken white meat. They batter it up and fry it and still call it chicken. Last quote from Dr. DeShazzo. It is really a chicken byproduct high in calories, salt, sugar, and fat that is a very unhealthy choice. Even worse, it tastes great and kids love it and it is marketed to them. Okay, let's remember, the United States has an obesity problem, particularly affecting children exposed to fast food restaurants and the advertising of fast food restaurants. Let us remember that Mississippi has a greater problem with obesity than most of the other states in the United States, and that this study was done of chicken nuggets sold in Mississippi. And let us ask the question, why is this bad health situation happening? Put aside whether or not the company is properly listing on the side of their checkout counter in small print a list of all the ingredients. I don't know whether they do or they don't. I'm not concerned with that. I'm concerned with the motivation to produce a product that the medical profession has analyzed to contain fat, blood, bone, cartilage, etc., comprising half or more of this food. There is only one answer, and you all know it. What drives this is profit. These companies can make profit doing this. They can make more profit doing this than producing a chicken nugget, for example, that is all meat. Otherwise, I presume they would have done that. I don't believe for a minute that they're interested in hurting children. I don't believe for a minute that they are unaware of what they put in these food products. I am aware, because I'm a professional economist, that in a capitalist economic system, what makes a company successful is maximizing their profits. If children are a target audience that will buy, if what tastes good to them is will make them buy it, and if what fills this nugget in a profitable way is bone, fat, cartilage, and nerves, we know what the outcome will be. It's what the researchers in Mississippi found. What's the lesson here? If you want to deal with the problems here raised, food that isn't what people kind of imagine or expect it to be, obesity for children, which is a national health emergency in our country. If you want to deal with these issues, you have to deal with the underlying economic system and the so-called profit motive that drives it and that its supporters celebrate as being a great boon for our society. And by the way, let me be clear. Are there some good outcomes of the profit motive? No doubt. No doubt. But what we have to correct is the wild imbalance that seems to need to pretend that there aren't tragic, awful, catastrophic consequences of that same profit motive, and that any honest approach to our capitalist economic system would be to do what we haven't done as a nation for 50 years, debate capitalism. Debate its strengths, debate its weaknesses, debate its pluses and its minuses. Do the same for the profit motive that drives capitalism. And then let's have a national discussion about whether we want a system that has this mix of benefits and costs, whether we want to limit it, try to reduce the costs and enhance the benefits, or maybe move to another system which offers us an altogether different mix of costs and benefits. A rational society committed to the best economic system it can get would long ago have insisted on such a debate rather than repressed it. The little story of chicken nuggets in Mississippi teaches us that lesson again. Let me turn now to a major discussion. And in doing that, I am going to take advantage of the interest around the world, and particularly in the United States, on the subject of medical insurance. The Affordable Medical Coverage Act, the Obamacare, as it's mostly called now in the United States, the effort to extend medical insurance to uninsured tens of millions of Americans, an embarrassment in a world in which most advanced industrial countries provide universal medical insurance to their people, either publicly or through private agencies, a bill that tries to improve medical insurance, make it impossible for insurance companies to evade covering people because of prior conditions they had before they got the insurance, and so on. I don't want to go over that. It's fairly well known. I want to deal with a different part of the problem. And first, that requires me to make clear what the problem is. The problem I want to deal with is not covering the uninsured, important as that is, or covering in a more equitable way, important as that is. What I want to talk about is the economics, since this is a program about economics, the economics of medical care altogether in this country. And I want to drive home the economics of it. We have in the United States nothing short of a medical industrial complex. I borrow that term from the origin, which is usually attributed to President Dwight David Eisenhower, many decades ago, half a century ago, when he, upon leaving the office of president, told the country to beware of the military-industrial complex. The cozy combination, as he explained it, and everyone understood what he meant because he had been the top general of the American military as well as the top civilian official, the president, so he really did know what he was talking about. He told us as a nation to be beware of the cozy relationship between the military, which we required the government to give them the money they needed to run the Army, Air Force, Marines, and so on, the Navy, and the fact that the military not only got all the money, but could be a powerful force in supporting the government, supporting the political politicians who supported them because of the wealth that the Pentagon disposed of, because of the number of people in the military, because of the people who depended on the military base located in their states, and all of those cozy, I scratch your back, you scratch my back arrangements. And the President Eisenhower told us to be careful. I think if President Eisenhower were still here, he would say the same about the medical industrial complex. And here's how it works. There are four industries that are crucial to our medical care in the United States. They are all private enterprises, and they have a very cozy relationship amongst one another and with the government. And I'm going to make that clear now, and I'm going to show you why that's the economic problem we have to deal with as a nation, and we will suffer so long as we don't. So, first, there are the doctors, the nurses as well, those who do the work of delivering medical care person to person. Number two are the hospitals, the clinics, the hospitals that are the institutional framework within which doctors and nurses and their staffs do their work. Number three are the manufacturers of drugs and medical devices, the private companies that make the medicines, that make the back supports, that make the ankle supports, all the devices, the x-ray machines, you name it, that are used in modern medicine as it is practiced in the United States. And the fourth and final industry is the medical insurance industry. These are all private enterprises. Doctors and their practices, hospitals, insurers, and drug and device manufacturers. Altogether, they are the medical establishment. They are the medical industry. But here's the economic problem. When you sit down and figure out how much we as Americans pay for our medical care, that is, how much we pay the doctors, the hospitals, the drug companies and device makers, and the insurers who we buy policies from, when you put it together, we in the United States spend more than twice as much as other countries, and in some cases, almost three times as much. Do we get twice or three times the quality of outcome? Absolutely not. There are dozens of studies that show that the United States doesn't get the worst outcomes of all the advanced countries, but doesn't get nearly the best. We are in the middle. We're mediocre. There are a number of countries that spend much less than we do, but that live longer. There are a number of countries that have a smaller number of deaths of babies before the age of one than we do. There are a number of countries that have all kinds of medical outcomes that we measure, that they measure and we measure, where they do as well or better than we do, and all of them spend much less. If we weren't afraid as a nation to face these realities, we would long ago have had a national debate that raises and answers the question, how on earth did it come to be that we spend so much more than other countries, but don't get anything better for it in terms of all the basic measurements of medical care, medical well-being, health, illness, and so on? But we don't. And we don't for a simple reason. And it's the reason, the same why we don't question, even when there are exposés, that we spend more on the military than any other society by a huge margin, and that there are scandals when the military are shown to overpay for toilet seats, for ballpoint pens, and for most of the other things that they get from a very cozy set of industries that supply them. We should have fought it when the president told us to. We should question the military-industrial complex, but we for sure should be questioning the medical-industrial complex. The truth is, a cozy truce was worked out between the doctors, the hospitals, the drug and device makers, and the insurers. None of them would blow the whistle on the overcharging they all engage in. Sure, they fight with one another. The insurers want to press down what is given to the doctors so they can hold up their insurance profits. But they know not to go too far because they don't want those doctors and nurses to become allies of the public against the insurers. And likewise, the producers of drugs want to charge more, but they don't want to push too far lest the insurers or the hospitals or the doctors feel aggrieved and break the deal. So it's an alliance among those four, but it's a shaky one. And they all look to the government not to attack them. That's why we don't have the government buying drugs in bulk and selling them to us cheaply, as is done in many other countries. Do Americans function like sheep? Are we willing to continue forever, even in a declining capitalist economic situation, even during a national crisis such as the one we've been in since 2007? Are we still going to not face the absurdity of a medical system that is out of control in terms of the prices it charges? Its insurers, its device makers, all of it. The answer is, I don't think we are. And I think a leadership position in this regard, and this is how I'm going to close this discussion, has been taken by the state of Maine here in the United States. It's not a state we hear a great deal about. It's not very populous. It's in one corner of our country. But here they are pioneers, and they are taking a leadership position. For some years now, Maine and its citizens have noticed what other Americans seem not to pay so much attention to. Just across the huge border that Maine has with the country of Canada, just across that border, Maine citizens have long noticed that people in Canada pay much, much less for exactly the same drugs that the Americans are taking. So stark has been that, that for years now, Maine residents make trips to Canada, particularly to buy medical equipment, drugs, and even to be treated in certain cases, because all of that is much cheaper in the Canadian single-payer medical care and medical industry that has much, much lower costs than we do. One of the important cities in Maine, Portland, Maine, even has gone to the point of, as a city, switching since 2004 to buy drugs from Canada. And from 2004 to 2012, the city saved its taxpayers $3.5 million by buying its medicines in Canada. It has had absolutely no problem with the safety of those medicines. The American drug industry has gone out of its way to suggest that other countries are somehow less concerned about safety and that they can't guarantee the safety, as if there were a danger. The mayor of Portland is now publicly on record explaining absolutely no problem, and they have every intention of continuing. We're Americans in other states, and there are other states looking to do what Maine has begun to do. Were other states to follow suit, we would begin perhaps to see the breakdown of this monopoly squeeze on the American economy that the medical industrial complex has perpetrated. Obamacare did not deal with this problem, so whether or not it survives, it remains for the American people to deal with this economic anomaly. Please stay with me as we normally take our mid-program break. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. We'll be back in a matter of seconds.
East of the river and south of the middle of town, I'm in love with my neighborhood. Yeah, it ain't to be here, not even close. It's what I like the most. Teenagers dwell outside of pop punk theaters, looters and beggars, least ring of pocket meters. Mr. Greenbeard, Noggy the man, play me your charms, hold me in your arms, bounce on, draw by some cools, and if you're lucky, unicycles, tricycles. I don't know how I got here, but I know I like it here. It's just what I do. And for the first time in my life, I think I really fit in, really fit in with this crew. 'Cause I'm lucky here, yeah. Really lucky here. Men walking with the 280 dog, specs locked on linen, designed to keep us spinning. And then I'm running to the redskin man, red in the street, but he can't walk on his
Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff. I want to welcome you again to the two websites we maintain where you can get more information and can communicate with us about any of the segments we produce and help us to be more useful to you after hearing from you than we might otherwise be. The two websites again are rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. The topic for analysis now is one that I return to often because many of you write to me about it and because it is an appropriate topic. And it has to do with the relationship between capitalism as an economic system and inequality. And I'm going to focus it on a city in which I lived much of my adult life, which I know very well, and which, while it is a unique city and like all cities has its unique qualities and dimensions, is nonetheless typical and emblematic of many, many cities, both in the United States and in other economies and societies. The city in question is New Haven, Connecticut. It's about an hour and a half east of New York City in the state of Connecticut. Has a population in the neighborhood of 120,000, so it's a city by American standards. It's one of the earliest cities in the United States, dating way back to the early colonial days when the United States was a colony of Great Britain. It is the home of Yale University, one of the richest universities in the United States and indeed in the world, a very old university as well as a very wealthy one. And the city has been a center of industry as late as the Second World War. It was an important center of industry, producing watches and clocks, producing textiles, being a major producer of munitions, guns, and all of that, a major producer of aircraft parts. In other words, a successful industrial city. However, starting in the middle of the 20th century, city of New Haven lost its industry. Now, let me change the language here to make it clear what the words lost its industry actually mean. Capitalist enterprises that had been located in New Haven, some of them for many decades, chose to leave. Some of them even chose to close down. They weren't making enough profit to stay in business, or, what is more typical, they moved. They moved to another part of the United States, often the American South, or they moved to the South and then out of the country to produce more profitably somewhere else. In other words, the capitalist system, with its profit motive, decided it could do better somewhere else than it was doing in New Haven. So the jobs left, the industries left, and New Haven became a city without enough manufacturing and other kinds of jobs to sustain its population. What it was left with was with employers who couldn't move. First among them, Yale University, spread out over 200-odd buildings, established there, very hard to imagine them picking up and moving. So they stayed. So did the local telephone company, the Center for the Telephone Exchanges, for a while at least, the hospitals and so on. White-collar work survived. Blue-collar work didn't. Indeed, the population of New Haven, for example, dropped from over 150,000 at the end of World War II to more like 120,000 today, meaning a huge percentage of the city was driven out, families uprooted from neighborhoods, children uprooted from their schools, forced to go to another city where, not infrequently, they settled in the hope that this wouldn't happen to them again, and yet it did, because what happened in New Haven happened in many other parts of the country. But New Haven had an advantage. It was the home of Yale University. Yale University is an elite school. A lot of its professors are connected to think tanks, to Washington government authorities. They could get government programs to come into New Haven. They could do studies of New Haven's urban problems and get grants to help pay for local people to participate in the studies. They could take the fruits of those studies and run to Washington to get government agencies to make experimental programs in New Haven. New Haven was indeed one of the original model cities, they were called. In short, New Haven had the problems of capitalism, the problem that the enterprises that New Haven had helped for years. New Haven citizens had worked and made those enterprises profitable. New Haven had used tax money to clean the streets, to build the streets, to maintain the air quality, to clear the land. I mean, in a thousand ways, the people of New Haven had helped sustain and build those enterprises. But under the rules of how capitalism works, those enterprises could and did pick up and leave when it was profitable for them to do so. They didn't have to pay back the city for all the benefits. They didn't have to take care of all the people who'd given the life of work to them. They moved to make more money, and they left behind social catastrophe for which they took no responsibility. It was left to the city and the people left in it to try to cope with the consequences of the private profit-driven decisions of the capitalists in the city. So you might imagine, and these promises were made in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s. I was living there much of this time, in the 1980s and the 1990s. Constant promises. We're going to overcome the decline of New Haven, the poverty of New Haven. Very quickly in the 60s, the city of New Haven became one of the poorest cities in America. For most of the years since the Second World War, if you made a list of the top 10 large cities in America, cities over 100,000, New Haven was in the list. Half the people, African American and Hispanic, settled there, came for jobs. Jobs disappeared, they're left. Year after year, promises made. The downtown will be redeveloped, a mall will be built, that will solve the problems. It didn't. New Haven will be designated a special model city. One government program after another will be brought here. The programs came, the condition of New Haven never got better. So here we are, 2013. And a report issued by Data Haven and reported on October 4th, 2013, in the Yale Daily, the newspaper of the university, comes to my attention since I am also an alumnus of that university. And here's what the data study of this independent agency, nonprofit Data Haven, here's what they found. I'm going to read through them and then tell you what it means. New Haven is now more unequal than 82% of the 366 major U.S. cities that are covered in this survey. There is a very high death rate from diabetes in New Haven. New Haven can be divided into a high-income, middle-income, and low-income community. Here are the conditions reported by Data Haven right now as I'm speaking. Among high-income residents of the New Haven area, by the way, the New Haven area includes not only the city, but the surrounding suburbs. Population, if I recall, in the neighborhood of 350,000 people. If you look at the high-income people, the percentage of those suffering obesity, 16%. One in six high-income people is obese. Among the low-income people, a larger group, among the low-income people, obesity afflicts 43% of the people. 70% of all restaurants in the neighborhoods where low-income people live are fast food residents. The overwhelming majority of the, not the total majority, not 100%, but a large majority of low-income people are African-American or Hispanic. According to the report of this document, which also uses the Harvard School of Public Health survey, New Haven counts in the 10% most segregated school systems in the United States. A recent study of third graders in the schools of the New Haven area indicate that among high-income neighborhood schools, 58% of third graders read at or above the national standard. Among low-income people, only 17% read at or above the national standard, 83% are below it. Among middle income, 21% read at or above. And again, the high income, 58% do. Among high income residents of New Haven, 84% have gotten, those who have these are above 25 years of age, 84% have a bachelor's degree or higher from college. Among low-income, 22% have a bachelor's degree or above. The city of New Haven is an extremely tragic city. It lives a degree of inequality that takes your breath away. Its people are dying of diabetes and obesity in direct proportion to their unequal income. The higher your income, the longer and healthier you live. Their school system is extraordinarily segregated. This after 50 years, during which New Haven was diagnosed as a city that capitalism had significantly damaged by abandoning it, a city blessed by a good climate, a place on the Long Island Sound, a heroic history that has in it one of the richest universities with the best links to Washington that a city could have. Everything there, you might think, to support the capacity to get out of its disaster, to improve from the tragic conditions of the 60s, but it failed. And the failure is not just the political and economic conditions and leaders of that city. It's not just the Democratic Party, which has been the governing party for the last 50 years without interruption. Nor is it just the failure of Yale University that has pledged to be a good partner to the city every year and never managed to do it. The failure of the city leaders and the university leaders to do better than this lamentable report that is carried in their own Yale Daily newspaper is a testimony to the severity of a problem of an economic system that works this way. It's too much what capitalism does to this society. It's too much for the political authorities to deal with. It's too much for the university with all of its resources to deal with, a university much richer than the community in which it is located, a university that doesn't pay taxes on the vast bulk of its property to the city that delivers police services, fire services, and all the other services at no charge to a university richer than the city is. No, you have to scratch your head and realize that the extremes of inequality illustrated in New Haven across the last 50 years are first and foremost a critique of an economic system that could not only make this happen, destroy a city that was important from the birth of this country, but find itself utterly incapable of correcting, fixing, offsetting, or improving the disaster of that economic system. What a testimony to an economic system that is long overdue for the criticism its current leaders are afraid to undertake. Okay, Last topic for today. Several of you have asked me to comment on the extraordinary events surrounding the City College of San Francisco. This is a 77-year-old institution that is one of the largest community colleges in the United States. It has served an enormous number of California folks, particularly in the San Francisco area. A huge percentage of the local people have taken courses there, have degrees from there, count that institution as an absolutely vital, precious resource of the city of San Francisco. So what's the problem? Well, it turns out that the City College of San Francisco is one of the public institutions that educates the people of San Francisco at a relatively low price. In other words, it makes higher education affordable. It is a product of all the social forces over the last 70 years that have emerged from working class communities, demanding a chance for their children and for them as adults to have the kind of higher education that before 77 years ago was a privilege only affordable to the wealthiest 5 or 10% of Americans who were the only ones who went to higher education in colleges and universities. So it is an institution representing and responding to a mass desire for high quality higher education that's affordable. In the current economic crisis, not the least of the consequences, and some of this started before the crisis of 2007, but it has been accelerated by it, not the least of the costs of capitalism's crisis is the attempt to cope with it with the fact that unemployed people can't pay taxes to the government of California or the city of San Francisco as they used to, through no fault of their own, that stores do less business and so deliver lower tax sales tax receipts, that the government is pinched when an economic system it relies on for tax revenue isn't working very well, which our capitalist system isn't. So one result has been for state and city officials to begin to withdraw resources from public, affordable, higher education. And here's how this kind of game is played. Usually the political leaders, who know very well what they're doing, understand that they are assaulting and damaging a precious resource that many people count on and that many people have benefited from. And they know, therefore, they risk being unpopular. So they try to get away with the following argument. There isn't enough money, they say, to pay for the kind of school we used to provide to you. So we're going to cut some here. We're going to raise the fees. We're going to hire fewer professors. We're going to use more adjuncts who have less background and training instead of full-time professors, and on and on and on. They try to use that argument and hope it is accepted. In the City College of San Francisco, an alert, aware, and militant student body, alumni, faculty won't have it. They understand that it isn't a shortage of money that's the problem. It's a shortage of political will among the leaderships in San Francisco and in Sacramento to go to the wealthy and the corporates who've done real well over the last 30 years and say to them, pay what has to be paid to sustain one of the finest institutions of higher education. It's a failure of political will that's the problem, not a lack of money. We know who has the money. We know where the money is. We know we've taxed that money in the past. Let's just do it again and get through this crisis without destroying the hopes and dreams for higher education of tens of thousands of our citizens and all the economic benefits that could flow to all of us if they got that education. Well, when that fight back happens, the people who want to continue to cut education rather than tax the excess wealth of the rich and the corporations. They have to come up with another argument, another way to try to take money away. So the one in San Francisco involves accrediting. The Accrediting Commission for Community and Junior Colleges suddenly descends on the college and finds there are some weaknesses, some flaws. I've been a professor all my life, starting at Yale University. There are weaknesses and flaws at every institution. Those can be identified and those can be fixed. If that's what you want, you go in, you identify and work on them with the faculty, with the students, in a collective cooperative effort to make this important service work better. That's not what they're doing. They are threatening to defund. The program is to find a weakness and use it as an excuse to do what they were doing before with the different excuse, there's not enough money. People across America and across the world should understand this is the form that austerity takes. In Europe, the people are fighting against austerity. At the City College of San Francisco, its teachers and students are also fighting. It's not just their fight, it's the fight of everyone in this society who wants an economy that delivers to the mass of people what there are resources to do, what there is wealth to do. And not to allow the inequality becoming absurd here to deprive all of us of the institutions that serve us best. City College of San Francisco is one of them. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I'm glad you joined me. Please follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. And I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.